This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, to be good with money, you need good information. You need information that's accessible. You might think you also need a lot of time. You don't. Solid, accessible information that you can put to work quickly and easily. That's what we're about today in this portion of the program. We're going to talk about making the most of our money. Two guests join us. They are journalists who cover the personal finance and investment beats for USA Today. Their names, Sandra Block and John Wagoner. Together with Kathy Chu, they are the authors of A NOLO Guide, The Busy Family's Guide to Money. The book covers the basics and more, from setting life goals to making a spending plan you can live with to handling debt and saving for rainy days, college, and retirement. There's also a chapter on investing and a chapter on management risk. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about personal finance for our guests, John Wagoner and Sandra Block. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, so if you're listening outside the local dialing area or on the internet, call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Sandra Block, John Wagoner, good to talk with you. How are you?
Good, thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, when we set out to begin to take a look at where we are with our money, it can just seem so daunting, you know? So where is the best place to start?
You want to take that, John?
The best place to start?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on, you know, where you are in your life. If you're just starting out, really the best thing you can do is to start with almost an anti-investment, which is to pay down your debt. If you're you have spare money but you have you know, high consumer debt, you're paying 20-odd percent interest on it, really paying that down is the equivalent of earning 20% elsewhere, and you're just better off paying that down. Now, if you don't have debt, then you do need to have an emergency fund someplace, just in a safe bank account or a money market account where you can tap, you know, in case, you know, your transmission falls out or your refrigerator dies or any of those things that always happen whenever you have a little more money than you think you do.
Yeah. Sandra, do you think that we might be hindered by feeling sheepish about what we haven't done or feeling that maybe it's just too late?
Yeah, and I think some of the numbers that you see about how much you need to retire probably cause people to throw up their hands when you see that you need $1 million or $2 million to maintain your standard of living in retirement. I think that causes some people to think, well, I'll never be able to save that much, so why even try? So I do think that getting started is difficult, but if you have a job and your employer offers a 401k plan and matches your contributions, that is an excellent way to start. You can start really small. You can start really young, which is the best formula for having a secure retirement, saving early. And because the money comes right out of your paycheck, you won't even miss it.
Yeah, and another thing to think about that can give folks some comfort is if you need to maybe step back from what you're putting in because of circumstances, you can do that. You're not setting your feet into concrete.
That's right. That's right. And in an emergency, although I don't usually recommend this, you can even borrow from your 401k so that money isn't necessarily locked up forever. But that's right. You can. And the important thing is if you were forced to stop making contributions, at least what you've already put in would continue to grow.
Yeah. Well, in this economy, we're feeling all kinds of pressures. And I'm wondering, do you think it is in times like these that we're more likely to put some effort into thinking about our money, our finances?
Well, I think this is the time when you start thinking about worst-case scenarios. You know, what would happen if I lost my job or if I invested in something that went completely down the tubes? And actually, you know, it's not a fun exercise, but it's one of those things that's good for you to do and look and see what your own personal safety net is.
Yeah. Actually, it's kind of a relief to do it.
It is, particularly if you discover that you're better off than you thought you were. on the other hand, it's a great exercise to do if you've never thought about it, because you still have some time to take some action and you know, shore up your own defenses a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think I like to do it from time to time because it makes me feel like I'm moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what suggestions would you have for couples, for single parents, for families in terms of beginning this conversation, for beginning to look at where we are and where we want to go?
Well, I think if particularly for people with children, what they really need to start early on is impressing on their kids what things cost. I just get the sense a lot of times that children grow up, you know, parents want their children to have a better life than they did, and they want to give them a lot. And it ends, the problem with that is that kids get things and iPods, TVs, all kinds of things without any sense of how hard you have to work to earn enough money to buy them. And that can really mess them up later on, because then they get credit cards. They don't get into the thinking of saving, of you know, postponing gratification, that sort of thing. So I do think that one way to start with a family is to really bring your children into the process. And if they want something, have them earn it. You know, have them save an allowance or something like that, so they really get a sense that things aren't just there for the taking, that you have to earn them, and that it's much better to pay for things with money that you have as opposed to borrowing to get things.
Yeah, and there have to be priorities.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. One way to do that, I mean, is just to kind of make a list. What do you want to spend your money for? Everybody likes to save money, but that's not a goal in itself. Ultimately, you want to spend that money. So what do you want to spend it on? Do you want to spend it on retirement? When is that going to happen? You want to spend it on kids' education? When is that going to happen? Once you get a list, it helps you to prioritize and sort things out.
Yeah. How long does it take to get a handle on realizing where the money goes?
Well, you know, a lot of financial planners, what they recommend to people just trying to get a handle on things is to take a week and write down every single purchase that they make, write down every dollar that they spend, because people have so much leakage in their budgets. You know what your mortgage costs, but you don't really aren't paying attention to how much you spend on lunch and coffee and gas and things like that. So I think that's a helpful exercise just to figure out where the money is going. Another thing that you can do if you are tech savvy is there are some really excellent software programs you can use to basically keep track of your expenses and really figure out what you're spending on necessities every month, how much is left over. And often that provides a way to figure out ways to increase your savings.
Mm. Yeah, it's also an interesting exercise to see how many things you're doing just out of habit. You know, you have the same credit card because it's the same one you've had since you were 23, and even though it's got a, you know, ridiculous interest rate, you don't want to bother changing it, or changing a bank account that's charging a lot of money, and you don't want to do it because you have so many other things hooked into it that it's hard to escape from it. It's surprising how much money between walking around money and kind of automatic bleeding goes on in your finances.
Yeah, and what's the right number of credit cards to have? I've seen people with, you know, their wallets are just bulging with credit cards.
I think that 2 or 3 is enough. I mean, you might want to have 2 in case one is stolen or something like that and you have a backup credit card. But I don't really understand why people have 10. To me, the real problem with that is if your wallet is stolen and you're worried about identity theft, it's a real hassle having to contact 10 different credit card companies and put fraud alerts on all those accounts. So I think people, even people who pay off their balances fairly regularly, accumulate these credit cards because of the rewards. But I just don't understand why you need that many, and I think it's dangerous because that certainly creates a temptation to use them all.
How many people use those rewards?
A lot of them do, but I think what people fail to do, they don't do the math necessarily. If you're paying a high fee for a rewards card, or if you're not paying off your balance every month, then you shouldn't bother to have a rewards card at all, because the interest payments that you're making are going to eclipse any rewards that you will get. So I think people tend to overestimate, and particularly with respect to frequent flyer miles, those are becoming so much harder to use. I think people really have to analyze whether the rewards cards are worth it. The people I know who use those and get a lot out of them put an enormous amount of time into figuring out how to get their rewards.
Yeah, it's a hassle. I looked into a rewards program through the bank that I use, and to get a $25 certificate off of an air flight, you have to have 100,000 points.
Yeah, and that's spending an awful lot of money,
yeah,
paying a lot of interest to get a relatively small award. I usually find that the place to get stunning bargains usually is in the credit card market.
Yeah. I'm wondering now, I haven't really thought about this, but I have a credit card that I pay off. I never have a balance on it. But, maybe one day I would need to carry a balance, so maybe I should shop around for a lower interest rate.
Well, if you think you might have to, that's the math that people need to do with respect to credit cards. If you always pay your balance off religiously every month, then there's no, you should look for a low, no-fee card that has, and, look for something that has some decent rewards, because that's just gravy. If you don't pay off the balance, or you think there might be a situation where you might need to carry a balance, then you've got to look for a low interest rate. And those cards are out there, but you have to have good credit to get them. And very often they aren't the ones with the best rewards.
Hmm. What can we do? Here's a big question. What can we do to achieve and maintain good credit, a high credit score?
Well, one thing that you need, the most important thing is just to pay your bills on time. That's the biggest dent to your credit score, is delinquency. So you just have to absolutely religiously pay off your bills on time and be very careful about that, because often people think they're paying them on time because they mailed in the check on a certain day. But if it doesn't get there, not only on the due date, but usually before a certain time on the due date, it's counted as late, and that will hurt your credit report. So with online bill pay and various tools, I think people can really, they need absolutely to pay off their bills on time every month. And the other thing you need to do is not run up too big of a balance, because what the credit score looks at is the amount of credit you've used versus the amount of credit that you have. And if you have, say, a credit limit on all of your cards of $10,000 and your balance is $9,000, that's going to hurt your credit report, because it looks like you're kind of in deep.
Okay. So that has to figure into looking at how much is too much in terms of debt and credit debt. I didn't realize this. I guess it's been a while since I've gone shopping for car insurance, but credit scores affect all kinds of things, including car insurance rates.
Yes, that's a very controversial issue. A lot of people, consumer groups, object to it, but it is definitely the case that if you have a poor credit score, you could end up paying higher insurance on your cars. If you're renting an apartment, you'll have a hard time getting an apartment. It could even affect your ability to get your job. And credit scores are used in so many ways now as a way to determine whether you're a risky employee, a risky tenant, a risky driver. So it's very, very important to know your score and do everything you can to keep it high.
Okay, that was one of the things I learned in the Busy Family's Guide to Money. Sandra Block and John Wagner are guests this afternoon, together with Kathy Chu. They're the authors of this book, which is a NOLO guide, a NOLO publication, The Busy Family Guides to Money. Money is our topic this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Sandra Block is a personal finance columnist and reporter for USA Today's Money section. Her Your Money column appears every Tuesday in the paper and on the paper's website. John Wagner is USA Today's investing columnist. He also covers personal finance, the stock market, and the economy. He writes an online Q&A column for the paper. His investments column appears in a dozen newspapers via Gannett News Service. And he's a regular commentator for the PBS Nightly Business Report, which, by the way, you can see on our companion station, WILL-TV, Monday through Friday evenings at 5:30. Again, the phone numbers, if you've got a question about money, about personal finance, about managing money, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So where do we find our credit score? How often do we need to check on it?
Well, you can get your credit reports, which is not the same thing as your credit score.
Okay.
Get your credit report for free from all three major credit reporting agencies once a year by going to www.annualcreditreport.com, and that is the only place to do that. If you, there are lots of other offers out there that purport to offer a free credit report, but they're not really free. So you go to www.annualcreditreport.com. You can order your free credit reports. They will charge you extra to get your credit scores, but it's not a lot. It's about $10. And I would say get your credit reports for free once a year and check them for errors that might affect your score. And get your score at least once a year. If you're getting ready to buy a house or make another major purchase, you might want to get them again just so you can see where you stand and see if there are steps that you can take to bring it up before you start applying for loans.
Okay. What do you think of credit card insurance?
I think it's a waste of money. I think that there's no reason. There are a lot of insurance products that just don't really make any sense, and that's one of them, because if your credit card is stolen, all you are liable for is $50, and most credit card companies won't even make you pay that. So credit card insurance and other types of sort of identity theft insurance basically are charging you for something that I don't think you really need.
Okay. And back to those credit reports, the three companies, are there likely to be big differences from one report to the next?
Not huge differences, but small differences, because not all lenders report to all three credit reporting agencies. So I think what the general advice is, if you're applying for a mortgage, get all three credit reports, because the mortgage lenders will look at all three of them. If you're just sort of doing a routine check, you might not need all three, because one will give you a pretty good idea of where you stand.
Okay. And if you're trying to get out from some debt, whether it be credit card or other kinds of debt, where do you begin? How do you figure out, you know, prioritize it?
Mm-hmm. Well, typically you want to try to get the highest interest debt out first. And, and this is one of those things where you know, if you do have money sitting in a CD or in a bank account, you know, it's really better to use that money and pay off that debt than it is to have it hanging there in a 2-3% savings account. It will improve your cash flow and help you a lot more than it would just sitting there. That said, you should also try to keep saving a little bit so that you don't keep getting into debt. You need to have, you know, some money handy for an emergency. So it's kind of a two-pronged attack. You have to try to pay down your highest debt first, and then you also have to make sure you've got something, stashed away for the inevitable new transmission.
Yeah. Speaking of cars, some folks might want to think about paying off their car if they've got the money in an account that's not paying much interest at the moment.
Well, I think especially now, because what we're hearing is that an enormous amount of people in this country now owe more on their cars than their cars are worth, especially people who own SUVs and big trucks and real inefficient vehicles. Those things just aren't selling, and a lot of people can't sell their car for enough to pay off their loan, which means if you totaled your car, you could be in big trouble, because what you get from your insurance wouldn't cover the amount that you owe on it. So I would say if you have a car loan, particularly a car loan with a fairly high interest rate, that might be something that you would want to pay off, especially if it's a car that you think you're going to have a hard time getting rid of.
Yeah, and especially if you have a fairly small amount of time left. If suddenly you're without a $400 payment, that really helps your cash flow a great deal.
Yeah. And when does it make sense to expedite payments on mortgages?
Well, I think that's a really tricky question, and people get very exercised about paying off your mortgage early. If you have a really low interest rate on your mortgage and you have enough and you're deducting it, there's an argument to be made that you shouldn't pay it off, because you're basically getting a low, you're not paying a lot for that money. And not right now, but in other periods you might be able to earn more than that in the stock market. And that's not necessarily true these days, but that has been true in the past. But a lot of people take great comfort in the idea that they are reducing their or paying off their mortgage or accelerating their mortgage. And what I usually say is make an extra payment a year. Make 13 payments instead of 12. And that will greatly accelerate the payoff, but it won't exhaust all of your extra cash because I'm nervous when people aren't saving for retirement and stashing all their money in their mortgage.
Okay. And John, Sandra mentioned the stock market. You want to – you're the investment guy.
What a fun job it's been.
Yeah. Well, I hope it turns around for you and everybody else real soon. But what are your thoughts today about being a smart investor in the marketplace?
Well, it's interesting because for the past decade, you really haven't made any money in the stock market, and that's extraordinarily unusual. I would say that the odds that the next 10 years are going to be like that are fairly low. What you have to do is match your investments with your goals. If you have a long-term goal, say retirement, that's 20 years off, then you should have a long-term investment asset like the stock market, which does tend to pay off over very long periods of time. If you're looking for something that's a shorter-term asset, if you're looking for something like college in the next 5 years, then you shouldn't let the stock market decide, what school you're going to go to, or what kind of house you can afford, because you probably won't enjoy the answer that you get from the stock market. So it's really a matter of matching your goals with investments. And I think a lot of people have gotten into trouble of late, and certainly in this last decade, when they mistook a house for a short-term investment. It's not. It's a long-term investment. Usually pay off over a long period of time, but not 2 years. You probably, you may get rich in 2 years in the stock market, but the odds are good that you won't. So, there becomes this difference between being a kind of a long-term investor and owner of an asset rather than a short-term speculator.
Mm. Let's take a call now. We have a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Our guests this afternoon, John Wagner and Sandra Block. They are journalists. They cover the Money Beat for USA Today, and they are co-authors with Kathy Chu of The Busy Family's Guide to Money. Line one, listener in Urbana. Hi.
Is it me?
That's you.
Okay. I have a question regarding the credit score. Does the length of stay in the same address affect your credit score, like if you change apartment every once in a while?
I don't think so. I don't think that is something. All that the credit score looks at is your ability to pay off your debt. So if you move around a lot, that shouldn't really reflect, as long as you've paid your rent or paid your mortgage, if it's a house, that really shouldn't affect your score. The thing I would watch for, though, is there are a lot of mistakes that pop up in credit reports because they take so much information. What happens oftentimes is one person's information gets mixed up with another person's information, which isn't good if the other person has problems on his credit. So what I would keep very careful watch over is, if you've moved around a lot, is that they do have correct information about you, that the address is accurate, that somebody else isn't showing up with a similar address on your credit report.
Okay, that's good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. When we need help in terms of investing, when we have some long-range goals, John, like a down payment on a home, college education, retirement, that kind of thing. When do we go for help, and where do we go for help? Financial planners, advisors, brokers, and the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first place, there's no shame in asking for help. There are some people who are just not interested in investing and would be rather play golf or fool around the garden or whatever, and that's the way it is. There are people who enjoy doing it themselves and people who don't. If you like doing it yourself, you have a ton of options, and they're all at a lower cost by and large than you would for paying for advice. On the other hand, when you make a mistake, the only person that you can really blame is the guy staring at you in the mirror. Mm-hmm. So, but if you do want advice, you need to be careful. You need to, first of all, check out the person's background and their record, which you can do online through what used to be the NASD and now is FINRA. And you also need to ask for references. But you also need to make sure that their interests are aligned with yours. Mm-hmm. We generally try to advise people to look for fee-only planners, planners that simply charge you a rate, much as a lawyer or another professional would do, or one who charges a percentage of your account, because theoretically, as your account grows, so will their compensation. But you have to take time. You have to make sure you're comfortable with the person. You have to make sure you understand how they get paid and that they will always get paid, no matter what they tell you. And you have to see if that's worthwhile.
Mm. And what is FINRA?
It's a self-regulatory organization for the brokerage industry.
Okay. So presumably they have some training or some things that they do for their members and...
Yeah, they keep tabs of who's been disciplined and who hasn't, and so you can look up a broker's record and make sure that he hasn't been thrown out of 16 other brokerages before he got to his current position.
Mm. And in terms of fees, what's reasonable? Fee only?
Well, here's the problem with fee only planners, and this is, I think, kind of the problem with financial advice in general, which is it is generally aimed at people with a lot of money. If you are charging a percent of assets, for example, it's hard to make a living off somebody who's bringing $10,000 to the table. Many of the top financial planners really won't look at you at your portfolio unless you have $1 million, $2 million. So that becomes problematic. Mm. And so otherwise, then, you have to look at other arrangements. Two things that I've found interesting. One is that several no-load funds offer pretty comprehensive retirement planning. T. Rowe Price and Vanguard and Fidelity all have nice retirement programs where you have to bring about $100,000 to the table for their advice plans. And there's also a no-load financial advisor network, which is called the...
Garrett Planning Network.
And they will... basically, you put in what you need, and they will kind of tailor a program to you. Is that right, Sandy?
Yeah. Basically, it's a network. It's Garrett Planning Network. And basically, what the founder has done is try to create a nationwide network of financial planners who charge by the hour and charge a low enough rate that sort of middle income people can afford it, and sort of their model is kind of like going to the doctor for a checkup. You don't necessarily get the ongoing hand holding that a more expensive financial planner would provide, but you get somebody who maybe will look at your 401k plan and tell you if you're going in the right direction.
Right. And for most people, they really need a periodic checkup. You don't need to have somebody check in with you every month, but you like to show your portfolio to somebody once a year or so and say, how am I doing? Mm-hmm. What should I be doing differently? And for that, you could pay someone an hourly fee, and that would be worthwhile.
Okay, so I don't need to check into the Mayo Clinic.
Yeah.
I need to go to the doc in the box.
Yeah.
Right, and one trend that is somewhat problematic, but I think we're going to see more of, is employers offering one of two things, either sort of altogether plans, target funds that basically have a premixed portfolio so you don't have to decide. And more employers are partnering with companies to provide advice to their employees. There's some questions about this, whether there's conflicts, but I think we're going to see more of that because there is a realization that people are being asked to take on a tremendous amount of responsibility with respect to investing for retirement, and they're not doing a very good job of it.
Well, let's take another call now. A listener in Mawikwa, line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is about online brokerages. I've had mutual funds for several decades, and I'm starting to branch out to get stocks. And I've been curious how secure the online brokerages are in the event that they would go bankrupt or something would happen, because in most instances they hold the stock certificates and they charge you a lot of money to deliver the certificates to you.
Right. Online brokerages would be covered by SIPC, which basically guarantees they will replace your securities in the event the broker fails or there's some catastrophic problem with the broker. Now, what they're saying is if you have 100 shares of IBM, and this goes for any brokerage with SIPC insurance, the brokerage collapses, they'll get you 100 shares of IBM. Now, they won't get you 100 shares of IBM at the same price as the date when the brokerage went under. So that could be either worth either more or less than it was at the time of the loss. But it's good insurance. It's fairly well. It's really very well protected, and I wouldn't be that concerned. I mean, the concern most people have with online brokerages is generally with security, and there too, they're very good at it.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, John Wagner and Sandra Block of USA Today. They are co-authors with Kathy Chu of The Busy Family's Guide to Money. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. If you've got a question about money this afternoon, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have that toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Another listener joining us this afternoon from Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
About a decade ago, I bought a considerable number of shares and subsequently sold them. And sometime later, the news hit the market that these shares had been manipulated during the period I owned them. And then I began to receive mail, and I've received three offers to be part of class action suit against this company as a consequence of that manipulation. And my question is, how many bites at the apple do I get? I applied for the first one that came and indeed did get a partial settlement. And the settlement involves the difference between, what the stock was estimated to have been worth without manipulation and the loss to me during the period I owned it. But do I also qualify for those other two actions that I've received invitations to join since?
Well, that's a real good question. I think that generally they try to make sure that class suits don't overlap.
Mm-hmm.
My personal inclination would be to say, well, what the heck?
It's
up to them, yeah.
Well, the worst that can happen.
Right, exactly. Lose the stamp. You know, so.
Yeah, this was a large company, and I can only imagine, you know, the millions of shareholders that were involved in that period of a few years when that are complained of.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes these cases cover different aspects of the manipulation, or they might cover different periods when they are manipulated. So I'd say go for it.
Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Okay.
For your advice.
You're welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about retirement, and we talked early in the interview about it can feel so daunting when you see things in the press that, you know, well, first approach the table with $1 million, $2 million, we can talk about, you know, where you'll be in your golden years. But that's really not doable for a lot of us. And there are some interesting things that we can take a look at. There are calculators that are out there. Talk with us about being realistic about deciding what you'd like to have to retire on and what you need to have.
Well, I think that one of the things that people have to be realistic about first is when they can afford to stop working. When John and I were covering this stuff in the 90s during the tech boom, we'd interview people, and they all said they wanted to retire in their 50s. And I just think these days that's unrealistic, and I even think for many people, early 60s is unrealistic. It's just people are living into their 80s and 90s. So you're talking about having enough money to live 25 or 30 years. So I think the first thing people have to really think hard about is when they can afford to retire and realize, and a lot of the calculators will show you this, I think T. Rowe Price has a very effective one that does this on its website, how much a difference just working one or two extra years can make. Because not only are you earning money during that time, you're increasing the amount of Social Security benefits you'll be eligible for, and you're not taking money out of your savings. Every day that you're working, your savings are working for you. So to me, that's the first step. Really think hard about just when you can afford to stop working. And if you're absolutely determined to leave the job that you hate, then think about whether you can get a part-time job.
Right. And the other big impediment, of course, is having health care between the time you retire and the time you're eligible for Medicare. And really, if you don't have that covered, it doesn't matter how much money you have in your bank account.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the problems with some of these calculators is there are huge variables. If you, for example, have paid off your mortgage, you're going to be in a much better position to retire than someone who's still paying their mortgage, because that's a bill that you won't have to worry about. It used to be it was routine for people to retire with their mortgages paid off, but we've seen so many refinancings. People have moved around. They've taken so much equity out of their homes that many people are retiring with a mortgage. Well, if you're going to retire with a mortgage, you're going to need more money to pay it.
Yeah. And here's another thing that I find very frightening, inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it is problematic, and one of the things that is a big problem about it is that a lot of very simple calculators don't take inflation into account. And you don't necessarily have to adjust upward every year for inflation. But even at low levels of inflation, every 5 or 10 years, you're going to have to give yourself a raise, or you're going to have to reduce your standard of living. And that affects, you know, how much you have to save.
Mm. This is, and to me, the inflation concern is one. I've written a couple of articles about the benefits of postponing taking Social Security, because the longer you wait, the larger your payments. And Social Security is adjusted for inflation every year. It's one of the few assets you'll have in retirement that is automatically going to be adjusted for the cost of living. And that's a valuable thing to have. The more money that you get from Social Security, the more valuable that annual cost of living adjustment becomes, because of the magic of compounding. So I think that people have to think really hard about when they're going to take Social Security, reconsider taking it at 62 at a reduced rate, taking it later, and realizing the value of that. I mean, it's going to be really interesting. Next year's cost of living adjustment for Social Security is going to be a really beneficial one for a lot of seniors, because we've had high inflation this year, and that's going to mean a larger adjustment.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Sandra Block and John Wagner, they're with USA Today, and they are co-authors of The Busy Family's Guide to Money with Kathy Chu. It's a NOLO publication. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you've got questions about money, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back to the problem of that that darn transmission. Let's talk a little bit about a reasonable rainy day fund. What does it look like, and where should we be keeping it?
Right. Well, you know, it's one of those things where you always read, you know, planners say, you know, you should have a equivalent of 6 months of expenses for your rainy day fund. And once you start adding that up, you go, well, geez, I'm never going to be able to save for anything else. The answer, I guess, really depends on how much, what your estimate is of how able you'll be to get a new job. If you're a nurse, you know, you only need about 2 minutes of expenses. If you're a journalist, you know, 12 months. So it depends on how, you know, confident you are that you can either get a new job, or that you can get along with what you have in reduced circumstances, if you have a spouse who works or something like that. I think, you know, the best thing for most young people is that you just need something in the bank for emergencies, because that's when people start to get in trouble with their credit cards. You know, they something comes up, they have to, you know, fly to visit their parents, or they have to get the new transmission or something, and they don't have anything, so they reach for the card, and suddenly they're, you know, $2,000 in debt at 21%, and that's tough when you're starting out.
Yeah, and that money, we want that money to be pretty liquid.
Absolutely. So, you want it to be really in a money market fund or a bank account.
Okay.
And there are some, in terms of the bank accounts, a good place to keep your emergency money is there are a lot of online banks that offer a much higher interest rate than you'll get going to your branch bank on the corner where you have your checking account, and might give you 0.5%. If you go to bankrate.com, you can find some online banks, perfectly safe, FDIC insured. If you're comfortable dealing with, you know, not having some face-to-face contact with someone, you can make two or three times the amount of interest. And this money is totally liquid. You can get to it at any time, but at least you'll earn a, you know, decent rate while the money's sitting there.
Yeah. Bankrate.com. Okay. And maybe, Sandra, you talk a little bit with us about this. Well, I think maybe some folks are a little skittish these days about banks. And I think the big thing is not to have more than $100,000 in any one bank. Are there other things to keep in mind as we shop for a bank?
What I would keep in mind, I think John talked earlier about inertia, and I think banking is a big cause of that. People put a lot of money into banks with high fees and low interest rates, and it's just too much of a hassle for them to take it out. But banking is a very competitive business, and there's no reason to subsidize the nice carpet in a bank just because it's close to your office or something like that, especially nowadays with the ease of electronic transfers. I would look for a low bank with low fees. I like credit unions a lot for that reason. Oftentimes they have very reasonable fees and higher than average interest rates. So I'm a big fan of, if your company offers a credit union, check that out. Credit unions are also federally insured by their own fund, so that money is safe up to $100,000. And in terms of the FDIC, no one has ever lost any money, any insured deposits in a bank since the FDIC was created. So as long as you're under the limit, you're fine.
Yeah, okay. And credit unions also, you want to check if you're eligible or if you're a member for loans. They often...
I think they offer very reasonable rates on loans. This is a controversy. Banks hate when I say this because credit unions don't have to pay taxes, and that's why they're able to offer these better rates. But if you're a consumer, oftentimes they are the best deals.
Yeah,
and a lot of times they are more willing to give loans to people who are just starting out.
Because that's in their charter. They're supposed to be there for not rich people.
Right. Yeah, okay. One last thing before we have to go, and we'll wrap it up with this. Any advice about the housing market today? I should have probably raised this earlier, but it's such...
Don't look at your house as a bank. You know, I think we were talking about emergency funds. In the old days, a home equity line of credit was a nice thing to have for emergencies, but then all of a sudden everybody got it in their heads that that was a great way to buy stuff, and that got into a lot of people in a lot of trouble.
Right. Don't look at it as a lottery ticket either. You know, in other words, what people were doing 3 or 4 years ago was saying, oh, you know, the Joneses, you know, quadrupled their money, and that's not normally the way the housing market works. You really get about the rate of inflation from a house, you know, in a good year, and, you know, when you see it soaring like that, you know, it's not going to keep up. Now, similarly, housing market doesn't usually collapse like this either. So you might be getting to the point where you could get some honest bargains out there in the housing market.
Very good. Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sandra Block and John Wagner are with USA Today. You can find them online at usatoday.com, as well as in the pages of the paper. They are also the authors, with Kathy Chu, of The Busy Family's Guide to Money. It's a NOLO guide.